It's the ERP Confab. I'm David Essex, editor-at-large at Search ERP with my colleague Brian McKenna, business applications editor at Computer Weekly. Today we'll check in on Oracle, which has been in the news a lot this month after strong first quarter results, its high-profile bid for the video sharing platform TikTok, and its ongoing virtual OpenWorld conference. We'll also get expert advice on how to choose from the many options for cloud ERP deployment. So, Brian, Oracle really had a very good quarter, I think surprisingly good quarter, perhaps even to them.
Well, I've missed doing my usual write-up of Oracle's results because I was on holiday at that time. But let's just briefly review what we're talking about here in terms of numbers. So, top line is that the total quarterly revenues, and this is for their first quarter for their fiscal 2021, these revenues were up 2% to $9.4 billion compared to Q1 last year. Cloud services and license support revenues were up 2% again to $6.9 billion. Cloud license and on-premise license revenues were up 9% to $886 million. Now, notoriously, those numbers don't really separate out cloud from on-premise, but that's the way Oracle's been doing it in recent years. Safra Catz, Oracle CEO, quick quote from her, top line, talking about cloud applications. Our cloud applications business has continued their rapid revenue growth with Fusion ERP up 33% and NetSuite ERP up 23%. We now have 7,300 Fusion ERP customers and 23,000 NetSuite ERP customers in the Oracle Cloud. So top line from Safra.
They really... quite impressive growth numbers in a quarter compared to last year's quarter pre-COVID that I think a number of people were thinking might still be too early in the recovery process from the big dip in demand of the last 3 or 4 months. And I think a lot of tech vendors will be quite happy to have anything like actual growth compared to the same quarter last year. So. One thing you mentioned how they never break out the cloud license revenue and on-premises revenue. Larry Ellison during the earnings call made a point of saying that many people misunderstand or they think that license always means on-premises. And I admit that I had that bias too at one point. And he and Safra Catz emphasized that they thought a lot of the people who are buying licenses are doing it as part of a plan to move to the cloud. However, now that you point out to me that they still don't break out the numbers, even with this emphasis and Larry trying to be very careful to show that that good license number doesn't just mean on premises, they still aren't telling us what the percentages are. And it would be interesting to know what the percentages are.
It would be interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, just to give as you rightly said, I mean, these are strong numbers. Mm-hmm. Quick comparison with SAP. So their Q2 numbers, so it's the same quarter, were also up 2%. It's a very similar growth. Mm-hmm. And that was 6.7 billion euros. So not, you know, the same sort of absolute number and in a different currency, but nevertheless, we're very simple when it comes to numbers. We're not writing for investors. 2%, so it's very, very similar. Salesforce, 29% year-on-year growth to $5.15 billion in their Q2. So still a kind of faster growth from Salesforce, it would seem. So they all seem to be, you know, doing reasonably well during this pandemic.
Yeah, you know, This is something we ourselves have commented on in previous podcasts, and maybe this is still what's helping, that they all, I would say, obviously, especially Salesforce as a SaaS-first provider of customer experience software, but also Oracle probably more than SAP have strong cloud options, especially in infrastructure. And then again, at the earnings call, they emphasized in the Oracle discussion that Zoom had their Zoom revenue, their revenue from Zoom itself also had tremendous growth. So the move towards remote work during COVID seems to have been, at least that percentage of the revenue has been going up. And so any of these vendors that were well positioned for the cloud seem to have gotten through things pretty well, but it's a little too early to say how this will all finish up, because as we know, people are concerned that there could be another big downturn and that the coronavirus could get worse in the next few months. So the vendors seem to be holding up pretty well though.
Yeah, they do seem to be holding up pretty well. Did Larry say very much about autonomous? Because he likes to boast about that.
He did touch on it a bit. Yes, he did. He emphasized more the Oracle Cloud infrastructure in total, including the infrastructure as a service, especially perhaps the infrastructure as a service and their cloud at customer option,
yeah.
Which is, they were fairly frank about saying that the generation two, or as they call it, gen two version of Oracle Cloud infrastructure, which I think also largely includes a generation two version of Autonomous Database, or at least the infrastructure surrounding it, that they are seeing tremendous growth in that. And they admitted that the first version, the generation one, was hard to use and hard to install. And so they feel like they are already seeing uptick and uptake in Autonomous Database and this overall Oracle Cloud infrastructure, cloud at customer especially, which I think is a way of running cloud, Oracle Cloud infrastructure on your own premises, essentially. So the infrastructure side of this is part of what really fascinated me about the call. It's not as if we haven't heard it from Oracle before, either at the Open World Conference or other public statements. And they did seem, though, to be emphasizing it a bit more, I thought, in this earnings call. And it really is kind of getting to be their calling card, that they have the whole cloud stack, that there are these pieces underneath your applications that you can get, the database if you're not already an Oracle database user, the infrastructure as a service, platform as a service.
That is the value proposition, is the red stack going.
It really is. And I have to say, and this is part of what I hope to get into in talking with Steele Arbini from SNP Group a bit later in the podcast. I, at least for me, and I'm not a technical person, it's a little hard to figure out what the real implications are, especially for applications users. And if we do focus for a minute on ERP, broadly defined as all the many business applications, not just strictly in ERP. What it all means for the typical user, certainly Larry Ellison would want to say that you can move off of Amazon Web Services, Google Cloud, you can go all Oracle all the time. But we also know from some reporting that I've read, mostly from the general business press, Oracle as a cloud infrastructure provider, I think they're not even in the top 10.
No.
All reading.
No.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting because when we look at things from our lens, whether it's on the application side or whether it's on the data side, the Autonomous Database and so on, we're aware of Oracle also being an infrastructure as a service provider. But if you talk to anyone, like, for example, my colleague Caroline Donnelly, who writes about cloud computing infrastructure a lot, Oracle doesn't figure. You see, it's all about AWS, it's all about Azure, Microsoft Azure, Google Cloud Platform, these what are usually referred to as the hyperscalers are the center of the conversation. And of course, we know that SAP really puts its clouds with the hyperscalers. It doesn't try to do the infrastructure to anything like the same extent that Oracle does. So I think that's also this year we've seen the emphasis on the Zoom deal that Oracle has. Although Zoom also uses AWS, it also uses Microsoft Azure. It's not an exclusive thing, but they put a lot of emphasis on that as a kind of proof point of the Oracle Cloud infrastructure. And similarly, now we have this proposed technical partnership with the owners, the Chinese owners of TikTok. It's another way of proving that Oracle is a serious player when it comes to infrastructure as a service delivered over the cloud.
I was watching CNBC, as I often do in the morning here in the Eastern time in the US, and Jim Cramer, the analyst, was emphasizing the infrastructure aspect and sees it as primarily an infrastructure play. I think there was a lot of question, including among the experts, about just exactly what Oracle's stake in this was or what their interest was. We've done some reporting ourselves, our colleague Pat Thibodeau, when Microsoft was also in the running for TikTok, the US operations of TikTok, was talking about perhaps a desire to get some of the consumer-oriented data that TikTok tends to collect. This can be very valuable for mostly for marketing purposes. But I think you're right, and probably Jim Cramer is right, especially with Oracle continuing to push its infrastructure story.
For Computer Weekly, Alex Crockston has been following the TikTok Oracle story pretty closely, and we've discussed TikTok as such being in peril, and because of course the root of this is that Trump thinks that TikTok is an arm of the Chinese Communist Party, allegedly.
Yeah.
So that's where all this has come from, the kind of initial idea of Microsoft buying it. And now the idea, and it's still an idea, really, it's not been approved by, help me out here, you're the American, CFIUS. I think they've yet to approve this technical partnership with Oracle.
I heard this morning there was reporting that it is probably coming very soon, possibly as early as today. There's the deadline that I think the president set in the executive order of September 20th, which as we speak today on the 15th is very soon. And so there's some thought that will be a moot point if this is all approved.
I also just did want to say that we have discussed the TikTok phenomenon on the Computer Weekly Downtime Upload podcast, which is our podcast. And my podcasting colleague, Caroline Donnelly, is an avid devotee of TikTok, as indeed are something like 2 billion other people. So I would recommend our listeners also go back and listen to the Computer Weekly podcast, and I'm sure you'll include a link.
I will. I was just about to say we will include a link in the page for this podcast.
And I was speculating that maybe Larry is himself a devotee of TikTok. I mean, maybe he's posted some short form 15-second TikTok dance videos.
One thing I want to say, just to backtrack, and I should have had my act together when you asked about the Oracle database, Oracle Autonomous Database. Larry Ellison did say on the call, and this is a direct quote, when you were an on-premise user, there was no way to get access to the Oracle Autonomous Database until a couple of months ago. So he says, now the Oracle Autonomous Database is available in the public cloud, our public cloud, and has been for 3 years, keeps getting better and better. But if you're on a big on-premises customer, you are a big on-premises customer, you didn't have access to the database. So he's saying with cloud customer and with database cloud customer at very low prices, you can now get it much more available than in the first 3 years of its existence. So there was a bit of a mention of that. One thing that Oracle was really chided for when this news was breaking earlier in the week, when Microsoft revealed that they did not get the bid, and they were the only, I think, publicly known bid. So then it was assumed that Oracle would be the one. I think as of this morning, at least the day after this became obvious that it was going to happen, people are still waiting to hear details from Oracle, that they have been relatively secret and not said anything. And certainly in the earnings call, this is before the deal was apparently finalized. The earnings call last Thursday, Safra Catz, the CEO, was very adamant in almost a kind of a humorous way, saying, "We cannot talk about TikTok today. Please do not ask us about it." And no one essentially did. But there are a lot of questions.
It does make sense, though, from Oracle's point of view, surely, doesn't it? Because it's a massive proof point for their cloud infrastructure. And they're not going to have to, they're not going to be integrating TikTok because they're an enterprise software vendor. It's a very different.
Good point. That's all the more reason why it is an infrastructure play for them, as people have been saying. There's no need. It's not as if they purchased an enterprise application like when, for a while, SAP owned the Qualtrics employee engagement and customer engagement platform, where there's a clear enterprise tie-in. It's basically run your consumer video app and platform on our cloud infrastructure. That's
with his 2 billion plus users. Mm.
Yes, I don't know how those numbers compare to Zoom. It sounds like it could be more, because Zoom is, I mean, there's consumer uses of Zoom, obviously, but a lot of it has been for business. So,
find out by the virtual Oracle Open World, we'll know.
Yes, very adept segue there, Brian. Settled. You probably read my mind, or you read my outline of what we should talk about. You know, I was looking at the agenda. I was finally paying a lot of attention, and there's already been a lot of virtual open world. there's things going on today. There was something, I think, earlier in September, and it really is stretched out. Steve Miranda, who's fairly well known, I think, is the senior vice president, who seems to be the main cloud application development leader at that company.
Yeah.
Presentation on September 29th. But as of today, they're starting with the virtual summit. I think they're calling all of these topical segments a summit. And today is Cloud ERP, Cloud Supply Chain Management, October 14th. The HCM, Human Capital Management Summit, will be stretched out in, will start in October and I think continue into November. We haven't heard many details about when the senior leadership will speak. I did see at the Oracle Open World website that they referred back to an autonomous database talk or presentation that Larry Ellison did way back in July.
So before coming on the call to do the podcast with you, David, I did reach out to my UK PR contact for Oracle, and he said it's not, in terms of the kind of look ahead documentation. Mm-hmm. That's not quite ready yet. And I'm interviewing Steve Miranda myself ahead of his presentation on September the 29th. There's not that much information there. I mean, what information that is there is I think quite interesting in how comprehensive it is. Mm-hmm. Because he's doing this thing that he did last year where they're kind of bringing customers forward to as proof points, and the things that he hits, at least the Oracle is hitting in this piece of blurb, is continuous innovation, adopting new approaches to enabling employee productivity, serving customers, streamlining financial management, and redefining supply chains. So quite comprehensive, and not just, if you like, core ERP, but you know, the employee side, the customer relationship management side, and supply chain management.
Yeah, it's beginning to occur to me, now that we've seen all these virtual conferences, including Sapphire's, and then Infor is having theirs today and tomorrow, that not only has the lack of inability to do an in-person conference sort of removed the notion of the sort of big bang presentation on day one or two, where they've stretched everything out. It seems as if, perhaps understandably, that new product introductions have been slowed down a bit. That it seems to be the way it appears to me, that And it could make sense that perhaps they're just trying to sell what they already have and kind of incrementally move things along in terms of new product development and upgrades, but we haven't seen.
That's an interesting observation. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that.
Yeah, I think that's what we're seeing, unless Oracle surprises us with some news. This is probably a good place to stop. That's it for now. Stick around to hear my interview with Steele Arbini, the Chief Technology Officer of SMP Group, who will explain private cloud, public cloud, and other deployment options for ERP. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Brian.
My pleasure.
Steele, thanks for joining us today. It certainly seemed that ERP vendors have been moving towards outsourcing their cloud ERP infrastructure. We've seen this a lot from, I think, especially SAP in the last couple of years. Infor has done it. And they're especially outsourcing their infrastructure to public cloud providers like Amazon Web Services, Google Cloud, Microsoft Azure. So how has that move by the ERP vendors, how has that changed the cloud deployment options for their customers?
One of the main things it's done, David, is allowed them to right-size their ERP instances, which is something that they haven't been able to do in the past. In many instances, the on-prem installations required them to, you know, plan for 5 years of capacity because they wouldn't get a budget request to increase capacity. Now, that's very difficult in the ERP world because there may be a goal from the board that they're talking about to buy five companies a year for the next 5 years, and they're going to get a 10 times growth in users, but the IT guys that are planning the infrastructure really may not be aware of that. So they have to go through this magic of capacity planning for a five-year stint that they may not have all the information for. And what does this really mean? That on-prem landscapes are not only oversized, they're double oversized. And so what does that mean? You're spending a lot of money that you really don't need to just because you can't get that budget request. So now, fast forward to the cloud mindset now, you don't need to do that anymore. You could buy what you need. You can even downsize a little bit, let's say as a result of a corona slowdown, and say, you know what? I'm going to reap those savings. And when business comes roaring back, I can buy up back to what I need to be. And that's okay in the cloud universe. It's just not the on-prem mindset that they're coming from. It's the ability to consume and pay for only what you need at that moment. Another example of this is, you know, we see many customers that may have very high utilization of their systems for, let's say, a 12-hour period per day. And then outside of those 12 hours and on the weekends, they go down next to nothing. You see a lot of the hyperscalers, for example, Azure is providing automated ways for them to turn off their systems in those down hours and, again, not have to pay for that. And that's really where the savings of cloud can really come in, when you can really optimize all of that. If you oversize and then buy a full 730-hour month, you're probably not going to get much of a benefit in terms of dollar for dollar savings in cloud. But once you do some of this other stuff, you're really going to start getting the savings. And this is plugging into all these deployment options that you asked about, these other things that they're offering. Also, I know that hyperscalers like Microsoft and AWS, for example, are investing very, very heavily in automating the common processes, support and maintenance that go along with these landscapes afterwards. So what they're going to do, or what they're working towards, is to take that whole landscape in and then give you a whole automation suite to do the routine management of that also. So not only do they take the landscape and you get it in there, but they're going to give you the tools to take on the automation. So it's really a game-changing way of looking at all of this.
Are there any disadvantages, though, to going this route towards the hyperscalers or the public cloud providers, if you're picking that option for your ERP? Are there disadvantages?
I mean, you got to be ready for it is the first thing I'll tell you. From the technical side, we think of We maybe have an ERP system. Maybe then we have a data warehouse or reporting system on top of it. There might be supply chain systems adjacent to that. And IT people tend to think of those all as separate. What I'll tell you is that that's a mistake. The users don't see it that way. They may not even know the difference. They see it all as one system. So your strategy needs to be such that you're planning to move all of this, or else you're going to wind up with some kind of split infrastructure with some things on-prem, and we moved ERP, but we didn't move reporting. And that makes your coexistence situation that much more complicated. Mm-hmm. Now, you may need to live with that during the move until you get everything there, but that shouldn't be your long-term goal. So straight on disadvantages, not really. I think there's plenty of advantages. You just got to be prepared for it, meaning you got to have the pricing worked out ahead of time. Maybe a 730-hour month is going to cost a lot more for you. So you need to look at some of those issues we spoke about. How are you right-sized? How are you getting the most out of your utilization? You also got to look at what are you going to do about the whole landscape. If you can address all of those questions, you will have eliminated, you know, the most significant of the disadvantages.
At first, it sounded like the best of both worlds, but I'm starting to wonder if it's the worst of both worlds. What are the pitfalls of the hybrid approach, and maybe why should you not expect to use it for very long?
Well, okay, so it's funny you bring up hybrid ERP, and there's two kind of definitions of that. Some might call that a mix of on-prem and cloud, or even a multi-cloud situation. However, you know, popular analysts are calling this hybrid strategy more a combination of providers for best of breed. For example, I'm going to use SAP for my ERP, but I'm going to use something else for my HR, and I'm going to use Salesforce for CRM, and so on. And I'm going to pick the best of breed for all those components. I'm not going to go with everything for my one mega vendor.
This certainly has seemed as if companies, especially that they had like a really customized on-premises ERP, and maybe they have a lot of manufacturing systems connected to it, that they might go to the cloud and like SaaS, but for just for Salesforce, for CRM, or maybe human capital management to Workday or something, but they would have a mix of the two and have to do some integration. So that's the impression I have of what some companies are doing.
I think you're going to have that either way, right? I mean, Salesforce is certainly the popular CRM, and I'm not calling them out in particular. We're just using them as an example. So no matter what, that's in the Salesforce cloud. So let's say you move core ERP to Azure. Fine. You're going to have that Salesforce integration, which you probably had when ERP was on-prem anyway, right? So you see that cloud environment as an extension of your on-prem landscape. What we don't see a lot of, especially in, you know, anything bigger than the smaller organizations, is this adoption of multi-tenant ERP, like the vanilla, uncustomized, load them up in a multi-tenant SaaS ERP. Not seeing a lot of that, because certainly larger companies have their customizations, they have their data security issues, they just are using cloud in a bring your own license situation, and using it like an extension of their own data center. They're not pursuing multi-tenant ERP. The smaller guys definitely are, and it makes sense for them, but certainly anything bigger than that, they're not doing that. That integration you spoke about in this hybrid approach, you're going to have it either way, because really the cloud is your extension of your on-prem data center. To the extent that you could move any of the on-prem stuff there, the more you can do of that, it's just going to simplify your support and maintenance. And if it becomes a standard app, if it's something standard, not like some homegrown developed thing, I'm sure that the hyperscalers are already hard at work standardizing the installation and support processes around that app. And there might even be things you can purchase in their app store that can streamline that installation and data migration for you.
You mentioned the multi-tenant SaaS ERP and the sort of generic nature of it. That might not have been the term you used, but I, think that was the idea. I'm wondering about that because, you know, like in the case of SAP with S/4HANA cloud, multi-tenant SaaS, single-tenant SaaS, and then the on-premises version, it has seemed as if the true SaaS multi-tenant version hasn't had all the functionality even of the on-premise S/4HANA.
Not at all.
I guess my question is, what does that mean for people who are trying to figure out whether they want to move all of their ERP to multi-tenant SaaS? If that's what they're looking at, even if they stick with the same vendor.
You know, the question is, does multi-tenant SaaS work for you? The reason it's not maybe picking up as much as we think or it should is because it's not working for a lot of people. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Multi-tenant, you can't have your custom programs, for example, right? You have to go vanilla, you have to go standard. Now, right away, right there, this is a non-starter for some. Some of those customizations that especially larger organizations have are mission critical and they run the business. If that's how, you know, a chemical company, for example, is managing compliance with hazardous materials, are you really going to tell them that they have to get rid of that? It's a non-starter. The other thing is everybody is squeamish about having their data in a multi-tenant install. They're going to say, wait a minute. You're going to co-locate my data on the same physical machine as my competitor and then maybe run some kind of reports on there to see what's trending and what's not? No way. We want to have our own system. We want to be in charge of the security. We want to manage our own customizations. So this multi-tenant SaaS is a non-starter on those two points right there. Because they need that. They need their customizations. They want to be able to transport in their third-party components, which is another thing that is not available in the multi-tenant SaaS offerings, besides things that are considered industry standard. So it's too much of a change for them and too much of a disruptive change. Mm-hmm. Now, organizations coming in new, let's say, to the S/4HANA world, right? They're not coming from an existing SAP landscape. So they don't have all of that baggage to bring along with them. And they don't foresee the need for it in the future because they're not so specialized that they're going to need that customization. This may make a lot of sense for them. But the larger ones, especially coming from, you know, traditional landscapes, it's too much. It's too much to take on.
What seems to be going on in the cloud infrastructure world and in the application infrastructure world, and it seems like the ERP vendors in particular and their partners are trying to give people the benefits of cloud, you know, like the scalability, ease of deployment, lower total cost of ownership, some of the stuff you said earlier, without the disadvantages, or like being able to run their software or the software that they like that is as functional as they want it to be, but get a lot of the benefits of cloud infrastructure without having to go to SaaS. Is that a fair take? Is that what's going on, you think, in the industry?
You have to ask, who is multi-tenant SaaS really better for, right? Is it really better for the end customer? Maybe in some cases, but who it's really, really better for is the ERP vendor, right? It's their ideal thing because you're locked into a standard footprint. They can load it up with as many tenants as the hardware can support. And as the technology changes, as they get to a more microservices, Dockerized type installation, they can change out that plumbing under the covers of how that SaaS is delivered to you, and you don't even know it, right? They can move from Linux to other operating systems. They could scale it out horizontally, scale it up vertically, and keep changing all of that plumbing because it's all standard to drive their costs down. While, since you're on standard, you don't see any disruption there. So it's really what they want more than what a lot of customers want. So, you know, that's the best way I see to answer what you're saying. And it ties back to that first answer, that if it works for you, if that standardized environment that you can't customize can only do data type configuration on, don't have full administrative access to. If that works for you, then I think it makes sense, because the vendors are going to work hard to drive costs down on that. Both so their margin increases and they could pass some of that savings along to you. But there are plenty of organizations that it won't work for. Also, another reason it doesn't work is because of data sizes, right? If I am a large organization and I have terabytes and terabytes of data, there aren't cloud-based database servers, especially on the HANA side, that have enough memory capacity to even hold that in a multi-tenant situation. So it doesn't work.
I was talking earlier in the podcast about Oracle, and I listened to their earnings call last Thursday, and they seem as much as ever to be really talking about their Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI, and their, you know, the whole Oracle Cloud stack and infrastructure as a service and all the other elements that can run underneath. In their case, they would want it to be Oracle ERP Cloud and similar ERP products. What does that really do, though? You know, it's a radically different strategy, it seems, from what SAP is doing, where SAP has largely gotten out of the cloud infrastructure business. But Oracle seems to want to own it. If you're an ERP user and you're an Oracle ERP user or planning to be, are there some real benefits to having those other lower pieces of the stack from Oracle?
I wonder if Oracle and SAP are on the same arc, but they're just in different points on it and haven't come to all those realizations that the other have yet. Like, I think they're kind of on the same journey, but on different points of that journey. To the extent that customers can handle a vanilla environment and have data footprints that are applicable in a multi-tenant situation and can do without the customizations, I think that multi-tenant would make sense for either of them, SAP or Oracle. So depending on how many of your customers fall out of that, those boundaries, is going to tell you how many are not going to accept it. Cloud is good for them. It's good for Oracle. Look at even Amazon's earnings. You see that there's some years that Amazon itself.com has actually ran a loss, and it was AWS that brought the stock profitable. This is a predictable earner for these guys, so they like it, right? It's all bankable service type revenue, as opposed to, you know, licenses, which can fluctuate based on economy and budget cycles and all of that. It becomes predictable expense. So it's great for them. And they like that. Shareholders like that. Shareholders like predictable revenue. Oracle is on that same arc.
I mean, I can see what's in it for Oracle. I'm thinking of like the ERP customer. Well, let's say they're not an Oracle customer, ERP customer yet, but thinking of being one, because they like Oracle HCM Cloud and ERP Cloud maybe, or they like the looks of it. And Oracle's going to try to sell them these other pieces, I think. Is it really such a big advantage if you're mostly buying the ERP to have all that from Oracle as the ERP purchaser, or is it really not much better than if you are instead going to SAP and you like S/4HANA Cloud or on-premises S/4HANA and you're getting some cloud pieces? And there's, you know, some of it's HANA Enterprise Cloud, and a lot of it's through the public cloud providers. Is it really such an advantage to be going the Oracle route in terms of infrastructure?
I don't think it's a dramatic advantage. There might be some. There's certainly some optimizations that you can realize by getting everything from Oracle. And that's always been the direction they've been going with engineered systems and so on. They want the whole stack. They want to manage the whole stack. It keeps the support easier. It keeps the customer happier because there's not 10 different vendors in at 10 different levels of the stack changing stuff, but everybody comes to Oracle and says it doesn't work. But you know what? I don't think you're going to get a lot of people to get out of Salesforce, for example, or they're going to get out of Office 365 for email and the document cloud.
You know, I realize that single-tenant SaaS and private cloud ERP are not the same, and yet it seems like they have some things in common. And I have heard SAP spokespeople and people pretty senior in that company talk about, because it's not multi-tenant and shared in the same way, and things are segmented more, I guess, in single-tenant SaaS, that maybe some of the same reasons for getting the single-tenant version of, let's say, S/4HANA is maybe some of the same reasons people might want some kind of private cloud ERP. Is that kind of the way it is? And can you kind of elaborate on the differences between those two and why people might choose one or the other?
Sure, it is. And it's kind of the middle ground between a private install in the public cloud, right? Using the cloud as an extension of your own data center, kind of a bring your own license type situation, and a full multi-tenant SaaS offering. This single tenant is somewhere in the middle there, where you're going to gain the fact that you don't have your data in a multi-tenant shared database. So what does this mean? Some of your data privacy security concerns can be alleviated. Some of your data size issues can be alleviated because now you're getting your own instance, so you have the ability to have a bigger data set. You can also have some of your customizations in there within reason, right? A little more than what's allowed in the SaaS offering. But it still allows the provider of that to have a little bit more control than they would in a private install to optimize the plumbing underneath what you don't see in order to drive their costs down and pass some of that savings on to you. So it is that middle ground. It'll allow you a little bit more freedom in terms of customization. So that's one improvement over multi-tenant. It's going to allow you to alleviate some of those data privacy concerns a little bit more than you can in the multi-tenant, and also have a larger data footprint that you can't have in the multi-tenant. And it's going to also eliminate all that admin below the application from you, right? The SaaS provider is going to take that from you. So operating system administration, like, you're not going to care if it's on Linux or Windows. You're not even going to know. You're not even going to have access to it at that level. Again, that's a layer of abstraction that they want to keep there so that any of that stuff underneath, they're free to change to drive the cost down.
What are the questions people should ask themselves? Not necessarily the vendor, but if they're trying to make sense of all these deployment options, what are some good questions to start with to try to figure out what their own needs are going to be so that they can find the right deployment option?
To start with, how customized am I in the first place? And how much of that am I really using? And how much of that is mission critical? Because that's the first thing that's going to be your anchor tying you to one or the other. And if you have a good understanding of that, by the way, which is the analysis we do through scanning the system with the SNP software to help you understand that when you're moving, that will be the first point for you to say, well, look, I have some customizations, but most of them I'm not using, or most of them have been replaced by native functionality in the target ERP, so I can get away from them. Because if you can't check that box, there's no point going forward. You can't survive in a world where you can't customize. So you're going to have to go to that private install. So if you can answer that, then I would start talking about my data footprint. Is my data footprint such that even with eliminating some of the data through like an SNP Bluefield and doing selective migration, bringing over only what I need, am I still able to fit in a size that is usable in or available in these multi-tenant situations, be it shared or not, right? For example, take Azure. The largest system they have right now, and it's even a dedicated system, it's not even one of their multi-tenant HANA systems, is 12 terabytes of RAM. Can you fit in that? If you can't, your decisions are going to be greatly, your available decisions are going to be greatly reduced. So can you get down into something like that? What does that mean for you? These are some of the starting point decisions. Another one, and this is the number one question we are always asked in these type of discussions with customers is, what area of my business is going to change the most if I move to, take for example, S/4HANA? This is their number one question. All this stuff about data size and customization, this comes later. They want to know, you know, what area of my business is going to take the biggest hit? We can tell them that through automated scanning at S&P. But once they know that, it's very useful in helping them tailor this approach. If I know in manufacturing is going to be my biggest change, well, based on what I'm using, then to go through what those impacts are in manufacturing, what they mean in the cloud-based multi-tenant, single-tenant, or private install will really help answer those biggest questions. I guarantee the users don't care about multi-tenant, single-tenant. Is it HANA on Linux or something else? They don't care about that. But what my biggest disruption in manufacturing or sales and distribution are, and how that is going to change what I do on Monday morning versus what I did on Friday afternoon, this is where the real questions are.
Well, Steele, I think that's probably a good point to end it on. Thanks for your time today.